I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 184 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is one of my favorite songwriters and musicians, someone who is looking back and pushing forward at the same time, David Lowry. He's the frontman of two great bands, Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker. And last week, he released a 2-CD, 3-LP solo album, Fathers, Sons, and Brothers.
Fathers, Sons, and Brothers. Each of us, all of us, everyone.
The album is a sort of musical memoir. It combines the songs from three previously released limited edition mail order CDs, plus some new songs and others he has re-recorded. Starting with the especially evocative Frozen Sea, one of the re-recorded ones, Fathers, Sons, and Brothers reflects on Lowry's life, personal and professional. He consciously decided to tell his story in song rather than a standard memoir, though now he has a Substack explaining each of the songs, which is kind of like a memoir, no? Some of the songs are about his time in Camper Van Beethoven, including We Hate You, which recounts the band's nasty breakup while on tour in Europe.
We really hate your guts and we will never be your friend again.
Yet in late April, the band played two shows at the Fillmore in San Francisco to celebrate the 40th anniversary of their joyful freewheeling debut album, Telephone Free Landslide Victory. Have any Camper members reacted to the song? As Lowry notes here, just 1.5 songs refer to his time in his commercial breakthrough band, Cracker. These include It Don't Last Long, which offers hilarious details about the band's fall from favor, while being a profound reflection on appreciating one's good fortune while you're experiencing it.
'Cause it don't last long, enjoy it while you can. It don't last long.
Did Lowry adequately appreciate the good times in Camper and Cracker? Lowry, who has a PhD and teaches at the University of Georgia, is one of the smartest guys in music. And it's always a pleasure to get him going about his songs and the business surrounding them. He discusses whether his and Camper's career would have happened had he not written Take the Skinheads Bowling. He tells of how Camper almost signed with the label after its debut album, his conscious change in songwriting structure on the Camper album Key Lime Pie, the almost accidental ways in which Low and Eurotrash Girl became two of Cracker's most popular songs, and whether he's surprised by which of his songs have had so-called legs. He also says whether he prefers his new album on CD or vinyl, and why one of these formats is the superior product. He offers his theory of how record companies blew it with the streaming business model, and he reveals what he's writing now and weighs the economics of recording these songs with Camper Van Beethoven, Cracker, or on his own. It's always a great listen, in song or otherwise. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with David Lowry. Good talking to you again. It seems like right now is sort of a time for looking back, despite the song Never Go Back. It's, you know, there's a lot of sort of taking stock. What has it been like for you to kind of, you know, tell your story and autobiography and also do like the 40th anniversary Camper shows and all this other stuff? Like, how is this all kind of hitting you now?
Well, it remarkably all rolls together in a way that's fortunate for me. I mean, I get to be around sort of the Camper Van Beethoven guys while sort of as we're going into the solo record, and there's things that invariably come up in the solo record about Camper Van Beethoven and stuff like that. So I've been able to sort of talk about some of those things. I'm also actually doing a Substack for each song. I hope I don't regret this. I'm halfway through it right now. I'm 15 songs into it. That's being around all the members of all the bands and stuff like that has sort of allowed me to be able to get some of like the historical things that I need to include in the Substacks about songs and stuff like that, sort of get them a little more accurate and stuff.
I mean, these albums, because you originally released three CDs, these autobiographical CDs, and then you've put them together in Father, Sons, and Brothers as a two CD and three record set, Red, White, and Blue, and with some extra songs that that you've since written and recorded, including I wrote a song called Take the Skinheads Bowling, which I remember seeing you play at Space, and a few other ones, and other ones you've re-recorded. The first three CD album, first three CDs were what, like, I think 1,000 copy mail order only. Was the idea like, yeah, I just want to get this all in one place?
Yeah. I mean, the reason I put it out, well, so the reason I went from sort of limited edition, three CDs of Father, Sons, and Brothers, but they were, I mean, sort of the same album, is I had additional songs to add to this. I basically had a fourth disc. And then also I wanted to move it to the streaming platforms, just for broader exposure. So I sort of repackaged, added new material to it, and then it's going on the streaming platforms, which none of these things have been on the streaming right. platforms. So there's just sort of a practicality there of getting it out to a broader audience. And then also too, those first three limited edition CDs, those were all kind of like works in progress, you know, maybe it's something I borrowed from the software world. Those were betas.
Okay.
Beta releases, you know, of sort of the final thing. And I think feel like they were really interesting to fans, but this is kind of the final sort of finished product with, you know, some of the songs sort of that were released before re-recorded or fleshed out or approached a little differently, plus I can't remember if it's four or five actual new tracks. So that's what it was,
right?
That's
like the first,
I think that was a complicated answer. So
that's the complicated is good. That's where we're long form here. But yeah, Frozen Sea, the first song, is one you re-recorded, and I listened to it, and I'm just like, oh, that's like one of your really lovely songs, you know. And I had on the beginning of the CD, and my wife was also, what are you listening to? This is really good. I'm like, oh, it's the David Lowery. And it was funny, my daughter who just graduated college was like, he's like, oh no, this is really good. And then starts Googling you and like, oh, he did Euro Trash Girl. And yeah. it was like the frat, she was at the small school. It's like the frat at my school, that was like the only song they would play was Euro Trash Girl. So you have
I'm not sure if that's an endorsement, but okay. Well, maybe it is, because say what you will about fraternities, there are always a lot of music fans in the fraternities.
Yes.
There's a lot of their life that revolves around music. So, yes.
This is also a very small, nerdy, artsy liberal arts school. So it's not like, you know, some big state frat party. It's frats and sororities there. It's kind of like book clubs. I don't think people stay there. They'll just have parties and stuff. So
right, that's great.
When you look back on like all the songs you've written, you know, including something like Euro Trash Girl, are you sort of surprised at the ones that have kind of stood out or stuck around the longest, as opposed to other ones where you thought, oh, this is my classic?
A lot of times, the ones that stick around for a long time were almost throwaways. Like Euro Trash Girl was just kind of written in on a day off in a hotel room in just outside the Holland Tunnel in New Jersey. Like that, so opposite of what Euro Trash Girl would make you think of.
Right.
And then it was almost like a throwaway. And a number of the songs have kind of been that have stuck with us for a long time, like Take the Skinheads Bowling. These were kind of almost they felt like throwaways at the time, but they had something enduring in them. So yes, I would always be surprised by these, because plenty of the kind of throwaway songs didn't do that, didn't stick and hold, pass the test of time, right? So they're almost all of them are not really predictable. And Low, of course, the big song from my career, which is, you know, probably these days, you know, accounts for 90% of all streams.
Is that right? That much?
Yeah. I mean, just because that's in the fabric of 90s alternative rock or whatever, it's just part of this stitching of, it's in the stitching, it's in the fabric of that quilt. And so kids who are like, I want to hear some 90s alternative rock, rely on some playlists. And those playlists have invariably have Low in it.
So, there you go.
Right. So that song too was not really viewed as a single when we recorded it. It just sort of like on sort of a lark, our video director, Carlos Grasso, goes, I want to make a video for that song. I'll do the video for the song that the record company thinks is a single, but I want to do a video for that song. And then sort of as he started working on the video, then the radio guys kind of got a hold of it. And they're like, yeah, we can actually do this as a single. Let's see what happens. And it also was not viewed as an obvious singer to anybody, professionals in the business.
Was the obvious single Get Off This for that album?
That was one of them that they thought so. And then some people wanted for that album was Let's Go for a Ride. But I was thinking,
no.
Even at the time when they said Let's Go for a Ride, I was like, you're just thinking, you're just trying to find the song closest to teen angst, which is what record company people do a lot of times, because they don't really know what's a hit either. You know what I mean? Like, that's sort of what that was. But yeah, Get Off This. And Get Off This is, you know, it's like our number three track, you know, I think on streaming services.
And two is Teen Angst.
Maybe, actually it's number four. No, it goes Low, Eurotrash.
Right.
Get Off This, Teen Angst. And no, Teen Angst, Get Off This. I think that's what it is.
I got an advance.
It's Low and Eurotrash are the globally Eurotrash is kind of a bigger song.
Right. Eurotrash is what, like track 77 on that record? I mean, it was like
69, I think.
69. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
I remember having the Kerosene Hat CD and you'd have to like wait for it to like, it was like each track was like 3 seconds. So you really like used up like all 80 minutes with this, like what, 45 minute album. And then like, what was it? Was it that and I Ride My Bike? Was that the other one that was hidden? I think so.
I Ride My Bike is hidden. Yeah. Those two are hidden. So, that's the case. Although you can also get those two tracks on, there's various single and EP.
I have a 4-song EP that it's on too.
Yeah.
Yeah, what was it called? Like Tucson or something like that? Or,
well, there's Tucson, which actually came out before Kerosene Hat, that has those, both those songs on it. And then there's some incarnations of the CD singles that sometimes have them on them. There's a bunch of different formats. You know what's weird, though, is there's a very small run of vinyl, and I don't think it was US vinyl, that doesn't have Euro hidden tracks on it.
Well, if it's vinyl.
Yeah. Well, there's vinyl versions of Kerosene Hat that are, I don't remember what country, if it's the UK or Germany or whatever, that of Kerosene Hat that don't have the hidden tracks on it because they didn't know they were there. There's also, you know, remember the old CD record clubs?
Right.
There's one run of the record club, apparently, of Kerosene Hat that also doesn't have the extra tracks on it, because they didn't know it was there. And they used to make those record club CDs like really cheaply. They would have like, if you had a booklet, like that CD has a booklet that folds out.
Right.
So the record club would always be cheaper, like not have as much artwork and stuff like that. And then they would just copy the CD, or I don't know how they did it, but somehow there's some record club version of that CD that doesn't have the extra tracks on it. I don't know, just weird. I'm just using weird format issues around that time with CDs and albums. You know, the thing though is like, so I just want to say this about Kerosene. People, so there's vinyl reissue of Kerosene Hat, but The thing about that is that album was made specifically for, you know, sequenced with the idea that you would have a CD, right? We didn't even know if there's going to be vinyl for that album, right? So even though people want vinyl of the album, like, well, that's not actually the album. The album was intended for CD and to be just this one long listening playlist, right? And then some surprises.
It's true that, like, the way albums were sequenced changed with CDs, because it used to be that you had the four corners. So you had to make sure that last song on side one and the first song on side two was, you know, memorable. And then, you know, so again, and then the last song, and then CDs, it was more, CDs became a little more front loaded, but also it might be like the quiet songs are in the middle and then it kind of picks up again or something like that.
Yeah. And there's also mechanical issues. Like, whereas you couldn't have a loud song at the end of sides,
right?
Unless the side of the album was pretty short, because the grooves are closer together. So the width of the groove is the amplitude. And so the last song on each side generally was quieter. So like Key Lime Pie, I believe we think about that. I believe. Yeah. So that's the last,
like Light from a Cake album, and Come On Darkness would be the last two songs on each side.
Yeah. And they're quieter mastering when they're on vinyl.
Turquoise Jewelry on
is the first
Beloved
song. No, is that the last one on that?
Yeah,
side?
Last one on side one, because side two starts with Waka.
Yeah. So that's probably different in that album's relatively short compared to Key Lime Pie, so we probably had enough headroom for it.
Right. Yeah, no, I always find that interesting. I mean, Abbey Road side one ends with, you know, I Want You, She's So Heavy, which obviously it's really loud, but it's also all distorted and stuff. And it's Abbey Road, and it's not the longest album ever. But yeah, because I've talked to mastering engineers also, and like a lot of times they're like, yeah, you just, you know, the end of the groove is definitely more, you know, is narrower. And that's one of the reasons people like these 45 RPM, you know, where you'll have four sides instead of two sides. And on one hand, you're just flipping it every 10 minutes, but then you don't have to worry as much about the, you know, the loud song at the end of side one.
Yeah.
And with this new album, I mean, you had three CDs that you had sequenced as these pretty short CDs. Now you have two sides. Now you have a double CD and a triple album. Like, does one in your mind work better than the other in terms of telling the story, or because it's like these, it's kind of this continued autobiography, it kind of doesn't really matter how it splits up because it's just your story in sequence?
It works better on the two CD because I can divide it neatly from, like, there's sort of the California to Arkansas, and then the second CD picks up in Virginia. To me, it works better. But we did very carefully work on the vinyl, so we feel like the vinyl has a good flow and a good groove to it. But it definitely breaks in different places, so that's, you know, fairly interesting. So the real sequence is probably the CD. And then the vinyl is a good alternate compromise.
Is the vinyl the same sequence, but just split up in different places?
Yeah, it's the same sequence, but just split into places. So there's one side that's pretty short to make it work properly.
My memory was that you're not a huge vinyl fan, and you felt like, you know, there's no reason people shouldn't just put out everything on CDs at this point.
Well, I like the artwork for vinyl. I've always preferred that and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, CD is a superior product. It's better, sounds better. I know people say vinyl sounds better. It's just not true. It's just because they got up and they invested more money in this disc, and it's kind of pretty and it's this thing, and you put it on this antiquated turntable and stuff like that. And it's got so many compromises in it that, you know, the CD is superior. It's cheaper to make. It's more, nothing like leaving a box of vinyl in the hot van in the middle of August in Phoenix to, you know, ruin $300 worth of vinyl.
Yeah, for you as a touring band person, it's easier to take CDs around.
Well, you know, also, but I will say this, right? That's one perspective on this, but I once had an end of the semester party at my house, and we were playing music, and just kind of playing music in the back office that opens up into the garden and stuff like that. All the students were out there, and I came inside, and one of my students was just like looking at the speakers, looking at the little mixing console and stuff. And he goes like, "What is this? What is this?" And I forget what band it was, but I was like, "It's so-and-so." He goes, no. "What format are you playing?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm playing a CD." And now, I mean, I am playing through like a Newmark DJ CD player into a recording console, into some, you know, small studio speakers. So it's a pretty good setup. But he was just tripping out on how good it sounded, right? I was like, "Oh, it's a CD. It says these are CD. Yeah, CDs are great." You know, so I thought that was kind of good. So it's not, I don't think it's just me. You know?
That's really funny.
I mean, technically we know that. I mean, you put things on a scope and you could see that. But I mean, also too, to just people have the reaction to it, you know, like once they hear something that's not sort of a little compromised by the way streaming works, the compression that's in the algorithm. Right.
Well, certainly as a storage, like I'd so much rather hear a CD than something streaming. I mean, it's just like, there's just so much more information and range and everything there. I just had Chad Kasem, who runs Acoustic Sounds and the label Analog Productions. And he also has a pressing plant out in Salina, Kansas. And he spent like a chunk of time talking about how much he hates CDs and how a CD has never made him cry, and that you lose all the emotion in music with CDs, and that if you don't have that analog, every step of the way analog listening to something, then it's all shot to shit, basically.
I think he's been captured by big vinyl, but no, I mean, that's kind of a taste thing. So what a lot of people who like vinyl really like is that you have to make some compromises. There's sort of an EQ curve built into the vinyl to make it sound right. And it's a more limited range. And some people feel that's a warmer sound and such. And particularly when you're talking about classic albums from the 60s and 70s, which were mixed with the expectation that would be the EQ curve that you would hear when you were listening to it, it might be a better experience. But in 1992, yeah, we're recording analog, but we're kind of mixing digital, mastering digital, certainly mastering digital. You're mixing to with the expectation that people are going to be listening on CDs. It sounds great.
Right.
If that's what your expectation is, it's going to sound great, right? The problem was the early CDs were like the vinyl mastering put onto CDs. And then you play that next to an album that was mixed for CDs. And then the old CDs would sound inferior. So there's a lot of confusion.
Right. Well, and then there was the whole sort of
listening to.
Yeah, and then there was a sort of loudness wars thing later on, where a lot of CDs were compressed so much that they just kind of hurt your ears after a while. But that's not because of the format. That's because of how they were, you know, processing it to make it just, you know, punch out of the whatever system you were listening to, or the radio or whatever it was.
Yeah, so that was all about like getting them loud on the radio, and then you never knew which song would be necessarily a single, so they were all mixed that way, and then they were all mastered that way. And it's kind of sad. On this album, actually, there's some cases where some of the songs, we have a really expanded dynamic range to the point where it's almost like when we went into mastering, like, can we get away with this? I'm trying to think of what, if I can give you an example. Well, Plaza de Toros actually starts out, the first guitar start out with is really, really quiet. Like you wouldn't do that. And then you wouldn't have done that in the loudness wars in the '90s. But yeah, there's a number of places on the record where we actually leave an pretty expanded dynamic range because
right.
It's not really much radio anymore. So
there's not there's a lot of space on the record. I mean, like you really can hear the individual instruments. There's not like, they're not like these dense mixes of stuff, you know, it's like, it's all pretty distinct and sounds really nice.
Yeah. A lot of it's just guitar and vocal. I mean, it might have a number of guitars on there, but a lot of it's guitar and vocal. A lot of it, even when it's fleshed out, doesn't have necessarily have drums and bass on it, which leaves you a lot more room. I mean, a lot of this was sort of, you know, especially the first few songs, not the re-recorded version of Frozen Sea, which is fleshed out, but a lot of, you know, so songs 2, 3, 4, are very minimal. I mean, they're just
right.
A couple acoustic guitars and me singing. Sometimes it's got little hand claps or things in there. But that gives you a remarkable amount of space and a really good, your stereo palette, your sound stage is really distinct and broad because of that. It's funny, I don't normally talk about the technical aspects of this. We're talking about the technical aspects
That's right.
a lot here, but it's interesting. Like, so Drew Vandenberg, who mixed a lot of this stuff, if not, not quite all of it, but almost all of it, actually was kind of the instigator of me making a lot of this stuff really minimal. He was just talking about how, like, the you know, words and stories, or the words and the story, is much better suited to sort of it being sort of minimal. And that I should, while I was doing this, his advice was try to just make the music the minimal necessary amount to make the song happen. Now,
right.
I didn't do that on every song, right? I mean, obviously, Frozen Sea is a pretty complex arrangement with Megan Slankard singing about playing a little keyboards, playing a little banjo, and then singing about 30 tracks of vocals, which it doesn't really seem like it, but.
Mom.
It's a very complex part that she's doing. It's like a string arrangement with vocals. And there's a few other cases where we do that, of Father, Sons, and Brothers. There's like 24 tracks of strings on there, plus, you know, 3 different keyboards and 2 different people playing guitars. And, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, there's a lot of tracks there. But a lot of the song is super minimal. I mean, Piney Woods, you know, 6 minutes. It's basically me playing 2 guitars, but one of the guitars, a lot of the times I'm just sort of with the base of my palm, I'm tapping out like sort of a sort of a thump to be the, you know, sort of the kick drum or something like that to move the song along. And, but that's it.
Took me way too long to understand this in my heart. Every man is someone's father, brother, or son. Live like this, you will be infinitely less an asshole.
You have this memoir, but you decided instead of writing a memoir, you wanted to sort of record autobiographical songs. Although now you're writing Substacks about them, so it's kind of like you're getting a little closer to a memoir. Is there eventually a memoir? Are you sort of happy with, you know, are there like holes in the story that you feel like you still need to fill in?
Well, yeah. I mean, so the irony is I did this album in lieu of sort of doing a autobiography, and partly because the rock autobiography is a kind of a it's formulaized in this sort of way that I don't like. Okay, so anyway, so I did this in lieu of writing an autobiography. But yeah, as you mentioned, now I'm kind of backing into it because I sort of ended up like saying, oh, I should write a few blogs, you know, sort of to explain some of these songs. It's like, and then somebody else is like, well, no, you should do this at Substack and get subscribers. Well, okay, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And I was like, well, maybe I could do it for every song. So now, in effect, I have essentially backed into sort of writing a memoir, although it skips around David Lee Roth autobiography. If I have this right, is just actually a series of unconnected vignettes, and it works pretty well. Gosh, I hope I haven't mixed this up with Sammy Hagar, but it does feel like this is David Lee Roth. It's been a long time since I read this, but they're unconnected vignettes. And so while I'm sort of dissing the Rock autobiography, I have to say this is the way of doing it. And that's kind of what I do on this record.
David Lee Roth set the standard for this, is what you're saying.
Yeah, unfortunately. You can blame David Lee Roth for this.
Well, Bob Dylan's Chronicles, you know, like each of those chapters is kind of disconnected and, you know, leaves out like enormous chunks of his career. But, you know,
that's true.
I mean, that's why everyone kept thinking, oh, he's going to do Chronicles Volume 2 because it's Volume 1. And he only three of the five sections are set before 1964, I think, as I remember it. Mm-hmm. But then he didn't. So, you know, go figure. Or you could do whatever you want. I mean, you're obviously like a natural storyteller anyway. I mean, even in, you know, It Don't Last Long, you know, and you're talking about, you know, getting dropped from the record company after you taught the audience to sing the label executive's phone number. I'm like, all right, that's a chapter right there. You know, I mean, if you're going to implode, you do it in entertaining fashion. So,
well, thank you. I think that's a good compliment. I mean, okay, so the funny thing about that is that you would think that in the autobiography, I would spend a lot of time going into, you know, like what happened with Cracker. But it's basically the entire Cracker career is basically dealt with in 1.5 songs, right? The entire like Cracker world.
The experience of Cracker.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of picks up halfway through leaving key member Claws, and then it is this, you know, It Don't Last Long. And then that's all there is out of 28 songs. There's a song and a half basically devoted to Cracker. I mean, Cracker gets mentioned before, but that's the only real, you know, where I, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, let me tell the story of Cracker and how Cracker became successful and then our downfall, right?
Well, it don't
basically in about 6 minutes of music, which
there you go,
just two songs.
Well, and honestly, and it's not even just that, because It Don't Last Long, aside from telling the Cracker story, also to me, because, you know, as also like an older person than I used to be, as we all are, it's a pretty profound song. Like, I think it's like up there in your, you know, songs of, you know, profundity, in that you do look back on stuff that you were going through and, you know, you were sort of irritated at the time. It's things that were happening and I don't know, maybe you didn't appreciate them as much. And then you sort of look back and you're like, yeah, it that didn't last that long. And, that was sort of, it turned out that was sort of this peak or this kind of key moment in my life that, you know, when you're living your life, you don't necessarily stop and think, oh, I'm living a key moment in my life right now. So there's more to it than just Cracker, obviously. Do you look back in general on different parts of your life and think, oh, I didn't appreciate this as much as, you know, I might have?
Oh yeah. I mean, that's what that song's about is, I can even look at, you know, the last couple years of Camper Van Beethoven, the early days of Camper Van Beethoven. I was just back in, I was just in Santa Cruz. Not in Santa Cruz. I was in San Francisco for rehearsals for the Camper Van Beethoven 40th anniversary. And the 40th anniversary kind of brought us all together, including two of the members who haven't played with the band since the first album and stuff like that.
You, Chris Mulla was there, right?
Chris Mulla and Anthony Guess. And so we had everybody there. We had like kind of everybody there from the early days, and except for David McDaniel. But it, you know, it was neat, and sort of us getting back together and sort of after all these years, sort of, you know, some of us like Anthony and Chris, I hadn't seen in, I don't know, 35 years or something like that. So, and so one of those days I had a little time off and I rented a car and I drove down along the coast from San Francisco down almost all the way to Santa Cruz and back, and just to get away, clear my head and do all that stuff. And then I went to rehearsal, and I was just like, I walked into rehearsal, I was like, did we realize, like, in 1985, like, we were, like, we lived in paradise. That central coast of California with the redwoods and the ocean and, you know, kind of the vibe of the town was, like, kind of this slacker town that you could live in really cheaply and work in a coffee shop and playing a band. And, I mean, I was like, did we realize that we, like, lived in paradise? We were absolutely, like, it was like we were in the Garden of Eden or something like
that
when we were first forming this band. And you know, everybody was kind of laughing. They were like, well, it's kind of true. Like, those were, like, I mean, we really should have just stayed there. We should have tried to preserve that bubble, but everybody moved away and went other places and did other things, you know, and, like, in some ways, like, never really like lived the same kind of life that we lived when we were there, you know.
And you guys were a happy band. I mean, you sounded like a happy band. I would think that just playing.
No, I think we weren't. I think we were young. I don't know if we were. We might have been happy in the very beginning, but we kind of weren't. And that was the shame of that band. I mean, from the second album, we already had, like, solo projects going, and you know, like, one of the things I remember is that the outtakes from Our Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart, not like songs that didn't exist, but just like an inferior version of Aya Fatima, an inferior version of some other song or something like that, just the basic tracks. Literally, Jonathan and the Monks of Doom recorded their solo records over top of those. And I actually think that's the tragedy of Camper Van Beethoven, is that we never really, nobody was ever really that happy with the band in the first incarnation of the band being together. Nobody saw it as their life. It was partly because, you know, I know a lot of people don't know this, but Camper Van Beethoven started as side pro. Everybody else was in another band. It was essentially a side project for everybody because everybody was playing. Like, I used to be the bass player in everybody's band, and I wanted to be the singer and the guitarist in this band. Jonathan was a guitar player. He was learning fiddle. Chris Mulla could play all these different instruments. We made him the drummer at first, right? And, you know, so Victor was a friend of my little sister's, and I was teaching him bass. Like, everybody was learning to play their instruments in Camper Van Beethoven. It was a side project. And in the first incarnation, I don't think anybody ever treated it as their main thing until we got to sort of the, you know, major labels, and then we sort of took it more seriously. But there's some good things about that too, is because we did a lot of things that were kind of throwaway because we weren't that serious. But yeah, I think definitely, I don't think Camper Van Beethoven in the first incarnation was a very happy band.
I think that, because the first time I ever talked to you was when I wrote about Our Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart for the Boston Phoenix, where I was after college. And I gave it like a 4-star review, and we were talking about Life is Grand, and just in general, I think at least in terms of the vibe of what you're putting across, it was a very upbeat record. And we're like, yeah, we're not like these angsty, you know, rockers. And so musically you were not, whereas then, so it struck me then, you know, when Key Lime Pie comes and you're ending it on Come On Darkness, I'm like, oh, something's shifted here.
Yeah. So okay, but yeah, if you mean like the narrative in the songs, the narrative in the songs were always light-hearted, happy, weird, you know, bizarre and stuff like that.
But behind the scenes,
at the band, of course. But, I mean, maybe it's kind of like how a lot of comedians are actually in real life, kind of really dismal personalities. They are.
Well, you have the song, you know, on this, you know, on the CD, the new album, which was also on the first of the CDs, We Hate You, which is sounds like it's basically what the other members of Camper Van Beethoven said to you when they were you guys were all breaking up in Europe, from what I can.
It's literally what Victor said to me. So it's literally what Victor said.
And we really hate your guts and we will never be your friend again is the chorus.
Yeah. So I made that into a chorus and tell the story of the last few days of Camper Van Beethoven being together the first time. So in the Substack, I explain this and I go into the background of more of sort of what's going on and sort of so one of the things actually is that Eli and Pi, at the time that it came out, when we were out touring on that record, it got mixed reviews. And it wasn't actually clear that that was necessarily a step forward for the band. And in some ways, it could be seen as a step backwards because we got actually a lot of radio play on the first album, surprisingly. I mean, the first major label album, Our Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart, actually... And Pictures of Matchstick Man, even though that got shown on MTV a lot, was actually a harder sell to radio. It was actually a little problematic, but in retrospect, it's, you know, sort of the revisionist history of that is like that, that was a big, you know, breakthrough for us. So, and it kind of wasn't. So it was a little bit like, where are we going with this? You know, where is this? We going down some sort of weird dead end with this band? Did we sort of get away from our strengths and what we're doing, you know?
And you didn't really get to work that out because everything blew up in Europe.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So I mean, obviously you guys did become friends again. At least you became a band again. I hope you're friends again. So how were you able to sort of get past that? And also what was their reaction when they heard that song?
I don't know if I never heard, none of them have ever said anything about that song. So I have no idea. It's been out there poking around. You know, it's, you can get it on Bandcamp and stuff like that. Yes, we are friends. Yeah, actually, in a lot of ways, we're way better friends than we were when we were in a band together the first time. And I think that's actually really important for people to understand. Also, too, there's some sort of viral internet wisdom from some singer in a metal band somewhere that every once in a while I see posted on social media somewhere. And it's something like, do not make career decisions at 2 a.m. after you've been, you know, drinking and your backstage is a closet, you know, in some dive bar in, you know, Lincoln, Nebraska or something. I don't know what city they
use. That sounds like sound advice.
It said sound advice, but that's basically how all bands make decisions, right? You know, that's kind of how Camper Van Beethoven breaks up, you know?
You just hit this one low point and you're just like, I can't take it anymore. As opposed to, I'm going to try to wake up in a better place first.
Well, just if you're exhausted from 8 months of touring and you know, time zones all fucked up and everybody was sick the week before and you're all like hungover or had a couple drinks and stuff like that. But that's how you're going to make career decisions. That's when you're going to have the band meeting and make a career decision, right?
Was there a key to, you know, what made it so you guys could get along again?
I think being just, you know, just kind of being older and sort of having a little more realization. You know, a lot of it was like, hey, we did some pretty good stuff when we were together. You know, we really we were really kind of nailing it, and we were doing something different than everybody else. I mean, look how well this music has stood the test of time. Not all of it, but you know what I mean? So, I mean, it was
most of it. Playing. I still listen to it.
Yeah. So Telephone, listening to Telephone Free, Landslide Victory, as we played it in San Francisco 40 years after its release, it came off really well. You know, I was like, wow, this is really great. We made this record.
How did it feel being with everyone doing those and having like the guys like someone like Chris Mullen, you know, these people who hadn't been in the band for so long? Like what was the vibe on stage? Like, was it, were people like, oh, I hope I don't mess this up? Or was there kind of like, oh, this is like a celebration, or both?
It was a Gen X, The Big Chill. So is that that movie that I'm thinking of?
Could be.
It was like an 80s. Movie, like everybody gets back together,
right?
Or they're friends from college or something like that, and they're listening to Motown music.
Yeah, they're listening to all the oldies.
Yeah,
that's where a lot of people heard White or Shade of Pale for the first time, was the Big Chill soundtrack, I think.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not Gen X, but everybody's just a little younger than me, so it's I self-identify as Gen X. I also went to college later than everybody else. I didn't go to college straight through, you know, from high school. It was a little like that. It's like, hey, what, you got a kid? Oh, how old are they? What did they do? You know, like, you know, just sort of getting back together and make a good movie of some sort. Just a character study or something like that. A movie that was like just character study, you know, because everybody's a really different personality. Sort of the way they approached life and what they did and stuff like that, and the intervening 40 years and the things they did and their experiences and stuff like that. It's really different, you know?
Do people regress to kind of some of the tensions, like what the way they were, like, oh, you're doing that annoying thing, or I'm sort of anticipating that you're going to do that annoying thing that maybe you grew out of 40 years ago, but I don't realize it, so I'm going to treat you like you're 20 years old again or something?
Well, not yet, but you know, we do have till September. We've got shows scheduled here and there through September. It could easily come back out again, because ultimately people never change.
But I mean, because you've toured with Camper a bunch of times, you've toured with them and Cracker at the same time. It's been a while since you did just a dedicated Camper tour, but I mean, so you've been in these dynamics before, and something must be working in that you're willing to keep doing it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I like everybody involved in all of this. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that, though, that anybody who likes people, any group of people that like each other, if you put them in a van for 2 weeks, they'll find out.
Oh,
they'll
sure.
Find ways to be annoyed with each other, right? So, you know, like dumb things like, would you please not special order, because then they make your entree wrong. Then our stuff's sitting up there under the heat lamp. And then we have to scarf it down and go to the show. You know, like really ridiculous things to get mad about.
That's funny.
You know,
yeah. When you play with Camper versus playing with Cracker, is it like a different, does it feel different for you? Like, do you feel like your job is different? I mean, you're singing, a lot of the times you're singing songs that you wrote. I mean, obviously there are collaborations in both bands. Camper is like the same guys. Cracker is you and Johnny, and you know, different people. How does it feel for you in being in one band versus the other?
Physically, Cracker's a lot harder. The vocals are higher. I'm singing almost the entire time. More forcefully, louder.
Fewer instrumentals.
Carrying more of it, whereas Camper is sort of this weird circus sideshow going on, and every once in a while I'll sing a verse for about, you know, 30%. That's about 30% of the song, and the rest of the song is instrumental. There's long instrumental passages, so it's a lot easier to be a participant in Camper Van Beethoven. I also love being in the rhythm section, like where I don't have to sing, and I can just hang out with the drummer and the bass player, and we can just find the pocket. I don't know. It's just always been my thing. I've always loved that. So in Camper Van Beethoven, I get to do that.
As a rhythm guitarist.
More. Yeah. Yeah. I was a bass player for, you know, that's right. How I got into bands and stuff like that. So I'm very much have a mindset for to be in the rhythm section, right? Like me, like I can talk to drummers all day long about their cymbals and their rich, you know, their snare drums and the size of the kick drum and the type of head that they have on there, because I was immersed in it for so many years, right?
You've got some festival shows coming up with Camper also. Do you have to approach those shows much differently? Like, oh, these are going to be kind of the quote unquote hits because it's just a shorter set and people aren't necessarily there just to see you the way they would be when they go to the Fillmore for two nights in San Francisco.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, partly they're shorter. So, I mean, we're playing Riot Fest. Riot Fest is basically going to be, you know, 10 or 12 punk rock, fast ska, Camper Van Beethoven kind of songs, because that's sort of the vibe of the festival. But also, you know, we just don't have a very long set. So it's a very different thing than playing our own an evening with Camper Van Beethoven at the Fillmore, where we play for 2 hours straight, right? That's an entirely, and it's a career retrospective, right? That's an entirely different show. But they're cool. I mean, actually, in a lot of ways, the festival shows being shorter and you're just kind of giving somebody an overview of what you do is a lot more chill. It's a lot more relaxed. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but it's actually easier to play to a really big crowd. Sort of more anonymous or something.
Yeah.
Sort of not as real as when you're playing in a, you know, the Fillmore with 1,000 people and they're right there and they're right there in your faces. That's really hard. That's harder. It's more nerve. That makes you more nervous than playing in front of a big crowd.
Right. Well, this is kind of a specific special pleading thing on my behalf, but being in Chicago and all, given that you're going to be here for Riot Fest, could you get it? Do they do like those quote unquote after shows where you could do like the sort of the full evening with at some club while you're here? So those of us diehards, because Chicago is a lot of diehards, you know, you got a big audience here. There are many of us who would have liked to have traveled to one of these other cities who would like to see the full set. Mm-hmm. Could you do it?
I don't know. I'm not sure what the rules are. You know, we're not very high in the bill, so I'm not sure if we're allowed to do that. But something like that.
Riot Fest after show featuring Camper Van Beethoven, and you do have a newer song. I wrote a song called "Take the Skinheads Bowling." How much did writing that song do you think actually affect your future in the band? Like, do you think that if you hadn't written that song, everything would have gone differently? Was that the sliding doors moment?
Yeah, I don't think there was a song that would have got played on even college, maybe got played on college radio, but that song got played on commercial radio and got played on the BBC and stuff like that. If that song isn't on that album, then we're just sort of like another Northern California indie, psychedelic indie rock band, like a Game Theory or I don't know, any number of bands from Northern California. We would have been a cool footnote to college indie rock, college radio, indie rock history, but I don't know if we would have gone anywhere. I don't think we'd have achieved the level of success that we did. I don't think we would have ended up with a major label deal, which maybe label deals meant something in those days.
Sure.
Having like real, you know, it wasn't the internet. It wasn't like sort of anybody could you couldn't get your music to anybody. There were real gatekeepers, and having a major label meant that you had money and professionals behind you that helped you break through. I don't know if we would have.
I mean, because that was on your first album, you know, the major label breakthrough was your fourth album with also, you know, Vampire Can Mating Oven in there as well. I mean, did you get signed because Take the Skinheads Bowling was a hit, or also because you did these, you know, 2 and 3 and the self-titled third album? I mean, there's a lot of good stuff on those records too.
Well, IRS wanted to sign us right after the first album came out, and everybody but me and Camper Van Beethoven thought that that was a sellout move and didn't want to do it. I was like, but IRS, man, it's like a giant indie label. So we wanted to do that. And so
interesting.
We would have been on IRS, that second record. I don't know. We actually probably would have been a bigger band if we had done that. But by the time we put out three albums and we create this really kind of good college buzz, largely based on the first album, though, still.
Did the first album outsell the other two by a lot?
Yeah. But they all actually kind of sold. I mean, they never sold that many copies, but yeah, they all kind of sold. But you know, a lot of the second and third albums, we're putting out those albums and people are discovering the first album, you know, still, you know, 2 years later. But so we put out those albums, but that then we did enough albums and we toured that at some point we didn't have like the bidding war for the band, but we had four or five bands coming around trying to sign us, you know?
Right. No, and you ended up with Virgin, which I didn't really know as a label that much of the time, but I have to.
Well, it was also a big British. It was also a big, you know, sort of English indie label, but it was very, very big for an indie,
right? You know,
at the time.
Yeah, I mean, like XTC was on them, so that was cool. But I didn't know them in sort of the U.S. though.
Yeah, well, they were also the pioneer of all these prog rock artists. Art rock and prog rock and stuff like that from the 70s. You know, isn't the first Virgin Records album Michael Oldfield's Tubular Bells?
Oh, is it really?
I believe it is.
I don't even know that.
It is.
I'll have to look into the history of all this stuff.
And Richard Branson was selling it out of the trunk of his car while he was like a college student in the UK. I believe that's some story, something like that. Anyway, so it's, you know, it kind of had this cool legacy, but then it was also, you know, by that point, it was putting out, you know, they were having hits and stuff like that by that point.
So when you were writing those Camper Van Beethoven songs, were you writing them because Camper Van Beethoven was going to play them? Or are these the songs you just would have written in your evolution as a songwriter?
Well, a lot of the first album is stuff from my previous band. A lot of the songs come from Sitting Duck or the Stoney and Gauchos. But it's a lot of the same people. It's always Chris Moll and me. But a lot of the songs came from there. But then, yeah, Camper developed its own sort of thing. So the ska comes from Sitting Duck and Estonian Gauchos, but then sort of the Norteño, more of the Norteño, really kind of hard Eastern European psychedelic type stuff. That's more Camper.
Right. But like something like Good Guys and Bad Guys, that seems like a song that you would have written whatever band you were in, unless, I mean, it obviously has a certain sense of humor to it, which fits Camper Van Beethoven, but there's kind of a chicken or egg thing. Is that why Camper has that sense of humor? Because you're bringing it on that way?
Well, yeah, the song's fairly sardonic, but I guess is probably the correct term for that. Or there's sardonic moments in it. Maybe that's a better way of putting it.
And catchy.
Has a good chorus, you know, a really
right.
catchy chorus. I mean, that is a song that I just kind of make up on my acoustic guitar sitting in my little attic bedroom in Santa Cruz, like shortly after we record the first album. So that is a lot of me, but, you know, Jonathan immediately puts that melody to it.
Sure.
Which is helpful.
The violin we're talking
all
about.
Me, yeah. But it's like the little organ part. Kind of the little melodic.
Oh, was Jonathan the one who went do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's him. So I think it's Jonathan. Sounds like Jonathan more than Greg. And so, you know, it's not just me, but yeah, you can see that song being the kind of song I might write for the first Cracker album, I suppose. You know, it's not the kind of song I would have written for my previous bands. It's
right.
too earnest for that. Even despite all I said about it, there's sort of like a a straightforwardness to the chorus and all of that that I didn't have in the previous bands. Previous bands were a little more art damaged or something.
I think I pointed this out to you years ago. This might have been for a Tribune story, but one of the things that struck me was that Key Lime Pie has almost no choruses of the songs that you wrote, you know, aside from the mm-hmm. you know, the cover. And the first Cracker record is like all killer choruses. But you'd sort of gone away from choruses, and you also hate bridges, but then Cracker is more kind of verse than Happy Birthday to Me or any of those songs. That was like a sort of a conscious shift on your part, or like, I'm writing for this band now and it needs choruses?
Well, I wrote choruses in earlier Camper Van Beethoven records, so it wasn't a conscious shift to go to choruses. But yeah, actually, so Key Lime Pie is interesting because I'm trying to use some of the narrative sort of approach that you had sort of in American music before there was a Tin Pan Alley. Like, in a lot of ways, the chorus in pop music is an invention of Tin Pan Alley. Before that, like, American music was all about these verses, and there might be a chorus or a refrain, but it would be really short. And then you'd have these, like, you know, you go back to these old folk songs or these old songs from the, you know, some of the American canon of songs, and they've got like 13 verses, you know, and stuff like that. It's all about the verses. So Jack Ruby's definitely me playing with that. It's like, you know, it's, you know, the old sort of outlaw tales, the, you know, the bad man, the stagecoach robber songs.
Right.
You
know, and musically,
lot of verses in them. So Key Lime Pie is the conscious decision to sort of go away, not really do choruses and just have it all narrative and verses, which is a lot like what's going on this album. There's some choruses in there.
Right.
A lot of songs don't. It's a downplay of the, I mean, look at Mexican Chickens. It's 7 minutes long. It's got two choruses in it. It's right. All verse, very long verse. I mean, one of those verses, I think, is almost, isn't it like almost 3 minutes long?
Yeah.
But,
well, You're a Trash Girl also. I mean, that does have a big chorus, but it's also a lot of verses. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. it's not a short song. You're a Trash Girl.
That's right. So that's been in there, but, yeah, so Cracker is just me sort of going back to normal songwriting rather than, and Key Lime Pie is a pretty big departure.
You know, well, it's interesting that you would take that approach on Key Lime Pie because it's sort of your second major studio album, and there's sort of this sense of, oh, it's going to build on the commercial momentum. I mean, not the way artists think, but the way record companies think. You build on the momentum of our beloved revolutionary sweetheart, so he's going to write all these like hits, and then you got something like Jack Ruby, which is... I remember just like listening to the beginning of that album and just hearing, you know, the opening theme and then going into Jack Ruby. And I was like, this is like one of the coolest openings to an album ever. And then it's just this kind of relentless attack. And there aren't these kind of like shifts into like, you know, the big chorus or anything. In a way, it's sort of an anti-commercial direction for you to go in, even though it's a very clear, you know, wonderful sounding record. But to be like, oh, for this album, we're just not going to do choruses.
Yeah, I know. When you're on a major label, you're just like, yeah, let's not do choruses. Yeah, it's just kind of, that was... So, you know, the other weird thing about that album is a lot of that I wrote with just me and Greg in a four-track. It's just kind of got a peculiar vibe and a tonality to it that because a lot of it was me and Greg like doing these things... It became a lot more about kind of the music rather than what I was. Let me just put it this way. I was already on this narrative trip where I was downplaying the choruses. And then so me and Greg writing the music together that's not like a pairing that's going to come up with big choruses, right?
Okay.
That's not going to be stranger melodies. Like, and stranger sort of tonality and stuff like that. Let's put it that way.
He's not going to come up with like the bonehead riffs that you were having Johnny come up
bonehead,
with.
Yeah, they might be cool riffs, but they're going to be longer, more elaborate, and probably in a scale that you're not really expecting. Yeah.
Was Jonathan gone? Like, was he there for part of the, when you were sort of creating the songs, was he already gone at that point, or was he involved in some of the creative process and then left?
He's involved in some of the very early parts of the creative process. But that was, just sort of literally, just we weren't getting along and didn't really feel like he was fitting into what I was trying to write. I don't know. Yeah, that's hard to say.
Yeah, yeah. But in other words, like part of that album sort of reflects his absence, as opposed to, there are other records where he's putting in the, keyboard part or whatever else.
Well, there wouldn't have been space for Greg to do what Greg does on Key Lime Pie. So his absence there actually opens up this sort of space for Greg to be kind of different.
So to skip ahead to now, are you still thinking when you're like writing songs? I mean, I don't know if you are writing songs, but if you're kind of continuously writing songs or songs come into your head, are you now like something happens to you and you think, this is like, another sort of chapter in my ongoing, musical autobiography. Do you still think of, this is kind of a Camper song, this is kind of a Cracker song, even though you haven't put out an album with either band in, I think, like a decade? Where are you in your creative process now?
I'm going to read you some song ideas. They may not be the song titles, the song ideas that I have right now. They will not be autobiographical. I'm on a different trip right now. So Cincinnatus, the Roman Emperor. Hunt's Brother Pizza. Do you know what Hunt's Brother Pizza is?
No.
Then that's the point of the song, too.
That I should know if of Hunt's Brother Pizza.
No. You shouldn't. But if you grew up in a rural environment, you would know exactly what Hunt's Brother's Pizza is. It's sort of about the fact that nobody knows what Hunt's Brother's Pizza is. But Hunt's Brother's Pizza is the biggest pizza chain in the United States, I believe. Or the biggest pizza franchise in the United States. Yep. Snap-on Tool Calendar. the Last Man on the Land, which is a story that the original Camper drummer Anthony Guest told me about his uncle and his cousin. We'll do that. Lakelandia, which is about sort of the weird kind of economics and sort of social strata that develops around a man-made lake. So this is these are all kind of sociological explorations and sort of almost like academic. Hats, about why hats have big brims or small brims, and sometimes it's practical and sometimes it has nothing to do with being like, why do those mariachis wear really giant hats?
Why do the mariachis wear really giant hats?
Well, you would think it's because they're the workers out in the field, right? And, because it seems like, like with Norteño music, that's very working class, like kind of music, right? And if you're out in the fields, you have like really big hats to shade yourself from the sun and stuff like that. And then if you're like middle class or upper class, you should wear a smaller hat because you're not out in the sun.
Huh. Okay.
But the mariachis with the big hats, they're representing kind of an elite in those folklorica dances. Why does the elite wear these big, why did they wear these big hats? Like, why does the big, why does the ranch owner, why does he wear the biggest hat of all, in Yellowstone and stuff like that? I don't know. Like,
do you feel that?
I don't really know. So I'm going to write about. Okay, that's gonna be a great.
Do you need to be able to answer those questions before you write, or is really the song about the questions?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No, not at all. So anyway, I just threw some things at you there. So you know, Paul Fussell Class. I don't know if you remember this book from the 80s.
What was it?
It's a historian wrote about. He wrote a book called Class. It was sort of tongue in cheek, but it's actually very serious about class in the United States, and it's not what you think it is. It's like he comes up with nine classes. It actually explains this age perfectly, it's an overlooked book. So I was gonna write about that book. I don't know.
Do you see these all as like
things like that?
And now, is this like a, you know, the next solo album, or would you do another Cracker or Camper, or is it all, you know, just whatever?
I don't think Camper's going to do another record. I just don't see them doing that. Cracker might, just because it's more economically viable, but it's also very expensive to do. I don't mean this as a dig on Johnny Hickman, but the way Johnny Hickman, you don't send him files. And then he gets on his laptop and he writes all of his part. He has to live the part.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you got to go to the studio and you got to set up the tapestries and get the candles and set the vibe. And you got to jam in the old barn and he's got to live the things and then play it. But it takes about 6 weeks to do a Cracker record. And that's really expensive with the way compared to the amount of revenue that we generate from a Cracker record. It's really, nobody gives you really advances to make records anymore. So you got to loan yourself your own money and your own time and all of that. So I don't know. It's a lot easier for me to make solo records right now. Not that I wouldn't.
Have you been joining that anyway? I mean, you had Palace Guards, which was before those last Cracker and Camper records, but I mean, you're able to.
Yeah, that was
almost
though from a different era though, because that was almost like it's like kind of what I did with this record, but those were very whimsical, kind of funny, sort of little, I don't know, very whimsical things. They weren't like kind of serious.
Right.
I don't know. It was more of a camper narrative or something in those songs.
I mean, on one hand, it's easier than ever to record stuff, but on the other hand, it's the economics of getting stuff out is more challenging. So I don't know. I mean, I actually had a question I'd written down, which was basically like how does sort of the current state of the music business affect how you like look at the art that you want to make and, you know, an album, like how much does, you know, the fact that you have to take into account the streaming and the CDs and the, all these costs, like, do you still look at an album like as an album, or does it have to, do you have to look at it differently?
Well, I mean, somebody has to pay for it. And if that's going to be me, which ultimately ends up being me for doing any of this stuff, nobody has any money in the two bands. So for me, and it's like a really weird story why it's because of my startup seed investor stuff that I did. I mean, I'm not living off of Cracker money from the 90s now, you know? So if it's going to be me doing that, I do think about that. I do. Am I going to, you know, loan 60 grand to the band for 2 years and possibly never get it back? I love my bands, but that's, you know, I don't know. Maybe the world is, if we're not selling that many records, maybe the world's telling us something. I don't know. If we're not generating that many streams, maybe the world's telling us something. So I know, you know, if I am going to do it, I have to be willing to just like do it as basically a charity. Right.
Yeah. Well, and you know, a lot of it is obviously where the music industry is, where they've, as much as it was bad for creative people to be compensated for their work before, it seems like it's just gotten worse. So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, we thought it was bad in a way back in the 80s. We didn't know it could get worse.
I did a story about, again, one of my stories for the Tribune, probably like 15 years ago, and I called you because you're always really smart on this stuff, was about, you know, so much stuff shifting to streaming, and you had some hope for Spotify at the time. Like, there were other ones that you thought Pandora was, like, not so great. And I don't know anyone who talks about Pandora anymore. And I think Jonathan worked there for a while, right?
Yeah.
But Spotify, you thought, well, you know, if they get to critical mass and they're compensating the artists well, and, you know, you probably couldn't buy a whole lot with your Spotify money at this point, I would guess.
No, and it's actually, it's not only been stagnant, but it's drifted downwards, the money has, and it sort of the hope with Spotify was it would be sort of additional revenue, but there would still sort of be a window of sales, and you know, like sort of, you know, like movies that come out, they're in theaters, and then they're maybe
right
video on demand, and then, you know, maybe there's some Blu-ray or something like that too, and stuff like that, and then after it's been out for a little while, then it goes to streaming where it's just kind of a pittance, you know. That could have worked, right? But somewhere along the way, the choice was made. It's like, no, it has to be available everywhere on streaming services.
Immediately.
And that's what all the major labels, their digital departments, decided that that's what should happen. And it blew up the possibility of sort of training the consumer to kind of, you know, have a little patience.
Like you do with movies.
Yeah, like you do with movies, training the consumer. And I mean, it just goes to show you that there's no real adult in the world. People who run big companies make all the same stupid mistakes that, you know, we Yahoos make, right? And that was a mistake, not having that window that the major labels and the large independents willfully inflicted upon themselves, right? That I don't think they'll ever recover from. That's why, hey, my advice to my students when they're working on stuff is like, hey, man, you can't just be a musician anymore. You know, like what you're looking at, you know, the biggest pop artists can just be a musician and make recordings and do shows, right? You actually, if most people are not going to do that, you actually have to do this weird thing, like where you need to become little today's Jimmy Buffets, or many people may in the Southwest know who this friend of mine is, but Roger Klein and the Peacemakers, who built essentially, yeah, they're musicians, they put out records, they make recordings, people sing along to the songs, but there's this whole experience that goes into it. They have all these different events that they do, and they're centered around the band, but you know, there's like a retreat, there's two retreats in Mexico that everybody goes to. You've got to build up all this other intellectual property that is, and the least important part of that intellectual property is the recording. You got to do the recordings, but you got to build up all this other stuff.
Right.
It's kind of, we shift later in our career with doing the camp outs, but, and that's kind of helped us, but yeah, you can't, I don't know. I don't know how the music business ever goes back to being what it was, where you get paid fairly for your recordings. You might get paid fairly for some other things, but you're not going to get paid fairly for your recordings anymore.
Yeah. Cause we grew up, the album was the thing. It was all about the album, you know?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, maybe. So maybe you get saved by vinyl after all, because the vinyl is like the one thing that doesn't overlap with all of the digital streaming, you know, reproduction sort of thing. And like for your people who just want to put that needle on that vinyl, they'll pay for it. And so maybe it helps.
It might. It's definitely part
we'll see
of it. I will tell you that I'd rather they did it with the CD, because the CD is less expensive to make,
right?
And is a superior fidelity, and it's more transportable. And I think it would be more embraceable if we could just train people to get back into that.
Do you do better if people?
Hey, some markets though, like in Asia, I mean, that's what they're doing, right? They're, like the Korean Japanese market is kind of this was being sort of, my understanding is it's sort of being reinvigorated by this sort of high, this windowing onto sort of this high definition CD. I'm not serious. Like, did you look?
I don't know that much about it.
Because
I know there's like all, there's the SACDs. Now there's like, the, you know, there's the Blu-ray audio. There are all these different sort of higher definition versions of CDs. But and then there are the higher definition versions of streaming also. So,
yeah, but that's still a pro rata where there's sort of a fixed pool and it gets divided up. So, you know,
it's not that helpful for
Taylor
you.
Taylor Swift puts out a, well, if Taylor Swift puts out an album, it bigfoots everybody else.
Right.
Like, it's the same amount of money that goes to creators. It's more or less a fixed pool. It's more or less the same amount of money that goes to creators overall. But if Taylor Swift puts out an album, it pushes everybody else's, you know, it's essentially, it is a zero sum game, which it didn't used to be, right?
Yeah, it should just, the game should get bigger. You know, there should be more.
I mean, it's marginal, the amount that she depresses our revenues, but it's an observable effect.
Interesting.
She puts out an album.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's all for episode 184 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to David Lowry for reflecting on the great music he has created with Camper Van Beethoven, Cracker, and On His Own. Go to davidlowrymusic.com to order Father, Sons, and Brothers on double CD or triple LP with red, white, and blue vinyl. The site also features tour dates and a link to his Substack, which also can be found at davidclowry.substack.com. Lowry has a busy touring summer, with Cracker dates June 7th at Red Rocks in Colorado with Big Head Todd and Cheap Trick, June 14th at Celebration of Route 66 Fest in East St. Louis, Illinois, June 20th at the Winnetka Music Festival north of Chicago, June 21st in Three Oaks, Michigan, and more. His solo shows include one at the Velvet Elk in Boulder, Colorado on June 8th, and three California dates, June 27th through 29th. Camper Van Beethoven will continue its 40th anniversary celebration with appearances at the Winnipeg Folk Festival on July 10th, the Petaluma Music Festival on July 26th, the 40 Watt Club in Athens, Georgia on September 17th, Riot Fest in Chicago on September 19th, and the 930 Club in Washington, D.C. on September 20th. And the 20th anniversary Cracker Camper Campout takes place September 11th through 13th in Pioneertown, California. Follow Lowry on Facebook, Instagram, X, at David C. Lowry. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who's one of the good guys. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. And give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll, at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.